in Mark today, the 8th chapter of Mark. Go to the New Testament, Matthew, Mark. That's it. You're right there. It's the first gospel written, but it's the second listed. Chronologically, though, it's the first. About 60 years after Jesus dies is the gospel of Mark. And we're in the 8th chapter in the 31st verse. Some of you know what has happened before this moment. If not, I'm going to tell you in a moment. But verse 31, he, Jesus, began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it. And those who want to lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world? To gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and my words. In this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." The word of God for the people of God. I am reading right now the biography of Reverend Clay Evans. You all know that name? So he'll be recognizable. Some will recognize him for his music. What a fellowship, what a joy, leaning. You ain't know I was going to let you do it on your own. You ain't know that. I can't hit that one. And others will know him for his leadership of Fellowship Baptist Church here in Chicago, right down the street, which he founded in 1950 at 25 years old. I am a distant admirer of Reverend Evans. We've never met, but I know the young man who was tasked with writing his biography, Zach Mills, and he gave me a copy for advance review, and I can easily commend The Last Blues Preacher, is the name of it, to the study of any preacher. And if you're a musician and a preacher, you gotta read it. Gotta read it. Now, the beginning of Clay Evans' story sounds familiar. A lot of us know this or know family members with this. In fact, it will resonate through time, and it will sit alongside the story of many black boys here on the south side of Chicago. For the first 2 years of his life, Clay Evans didn't speak a word. He was a sickly child, they said. He was sick in the hospital. They didn't really have a hospital, in the clinic all the time, and which meant it was a combination now of medical inattention. He couldn't go to the doctor enough. The trauma of being black in the deep south now, that played a part. There were family systems. He had a whole bunch of siblings, and the mystery of the universe. Sometimes we don't know why a thing happens, but for the first 2 years of his life, Reverend Clay Evans didn't say a word, and all of this contributed to his silencing. And his mother was very burdened by that. She prayed and prayed and prayed that I would talk, Reverend Evans said. She prayed and prayed and prayed. And this is one of the most important and lasting memories of his mother, of who she was. She prayed and prayed and prayed. Now, she had a good southern name too, did his mother, Esther Newley. That's a good southern name right there, Esther Newley. And Esther Newley would wait in anxious vigil, he said, through long and sleepless nights. While the rest of the children and her husband was sleeping, she was up praying. Friends would ask her if she ever thought that he would ever speak. And she said, honestly, I don't know. But she prayed and prayed and prayed. She wouldn't let a little doubt keep her from praying. She wouldn't let overwhelmed keep her from praying. And one day, while his mother was talking to her friends about him, he interjected, "Who, me?" And these were his first words, and he said them to her almost as if he had been talking his whole life. She had been talking about a Christmas present she was going to get for him. She didn't think he could hear either. You want to get your kids to listen, talk about gifts. Who, me? Wait, what happened? Have I not been talking this whole time? When it happened, Esther Newley dropped to her knees in front of everybody, and with tears in her eyes, she dedicated her son to the Lord right then and there. Because of her, so many people will find inspiration in the Reverend Clay Evans, but they will never say her name. But because of her, saints are people who, because of their faith, make our faith stronger. The ancestors who made it known, they're not with us anymore, but they made it known in their life and their activity and the way that they talked about God that their faith was part of their identity. Y'all got some saints like that, some people who came up letting you know that this is what they believe, and they really don't care whether you, it wasn't a debate, you know, like this, listen, I'm praying for you even if you don't believe in God, okay? I am praying for you. And their faith is so strong, it somehow becomes part of our identity, sometimes without us even knowing it. We find ourselves saying and doing things that our saints did. Every human being deserves the blessing of having a saint in their life. Whether that's somebody you admire from afar, or as Helen Baylor once sang, "I had a praying grandmother. And I had my Aunt Mary, that was my saint." Now, my Aunt Mary, my goodness, oh, she would pray so much. And she would talk to others about God so much. And she would take me to church so much. Like, my goodness, they came out of this black church tradition, right, that made faith a public part of their identity. In the black church tradition, faith is not something you keep and maybe it's a secret whether you believe. No, you share it because it was a part of a reservoir of strength that even if you didn't feel strong, I could see that woman dancing down the hall and know, like, whoo, man, I don't know how I believe about God, but I want to believe in God like she believe in God. I don't know if I'm going to ever dance like that, but my goodness. Richard Wright calls this the endemic capacity to live in the midst of all that is around us. It's what James Cone called the openness to the intensity of life's pains without being overwhelmed by them. Church gave them this. Community gave them this. So when I think about her, I can't avoid her faithfulness. She was a saint. That's just who she was. And I gotta say, there are some times when I miss the saints, y'all. I miss the saints, especially now. Their way of being, it was so brave, from rising against injustice to hustling to make ends meet in a broken system. All the way down to how my Aunt Mary, now all saints can do this. This is just something they know how to do. Your saints did this too. They could talk to someone in a store for 5 minutes, and after 5 minutes, they would know all their business. Because when you meet a saint, you want to tell a saint about your life, right? Like, they would know all your business. Never go on errands with saints, okay? Never do that. Oh, I'm going to just make a quick run to JCPenney real quick. Every errand is an opportunity for pastoral care. It was so embarrassing, too, to hear my aunt. She was like, oh, my God, this God thing again. Ugh. But she did not care. I was having a Peter moment. Then, I still have it sometimes. Peter did not mind being with Jesus, y'all. No, of course not. Listening to Jesus, sitting at the feet of Jesus, learning from Jesus before this moment in the scripture in chapter 8. Now, they had fed 4,000 people. And Peter is like, oh yeah, you heard of Jesus? You know that's my friend, right? I got Jesus in my phone right here. And then the Pharisees ask for a sign. Show us you're real, Jesus. And then Jesus gets in their face, and instead of showing them a sign, he said, I'm not giving you nothing. And you know what? You don't tell me what to do either. Dad! That's my boy Jesus right there. That's right, Jesus. You tell them. You let them know. We ain't doing nothing. They bring a blind man after that, and then Jesus heals the blind man right then and there, and Peter is delighted. They all are. Because of Jesus. Because of Jesus, Simon and Andrew can get the best tables at the most exclusive restaurants. Oh, we're full, but you know I'm with Jesus, right? Oh, really? James can sit on the floor at the Bulls games, and they put the camera on him too, like, oh, it's James, he here today, dang! Peter is so popular, he got Instagram pictures with Beyonce, and Beyonce posted them. Dang! Peter thinking about running for office. Things are going great, me and Jesus, we the best of friends. Until Jesus keeps being Jesus. Until he starts talking about suffering. Not victory, but suffering. Not joy and righteousness, but sin. And how suffering is a part of his purpose. Wait, what? And how he'll be rejected one day. Well, everybody get rejected, Jesus. And he'll be killed. Okay. And after 3 days, he'll rise again. All right. And you could tell, listen, the disciples, they needed a powwow after this, all right? We need to get together. They probably talked with Jesus not in the room. First of all, I ain't sign up for this. Second of all, when he talks like that, he makes people uncomfortable. They don't like him as much. And if people get too uncomfortable, this life that we have built up for ourselves is going to be taken away from us. You know what, Peter? You're the leader, Peter. You go tell him to be quiet. We drew straws and your name came up. Peter, you go. Tell him, because as verse 32 reminds us, he was saying all of this quite openly. When we build up a life for ourselves, when we build up a life for ourselves, a way that we want people to respond to us and react to us, when we build up a life for ourselves, a personality, an identity that works just fine for us and everybody else, even if it is inadequate, even if we know it's far from God, but if it is working, once a couple things go right, we become increasingly hostile to anything that would disrupt the delicate balance of our fragile lives. This is working. It is working, right? It's working. And we will continue to go down the path of a wrong thing. Anybody did something wrong knowing it was wrong, but it was working? Then to stop and pursue another way, another life. We know this is what we should be doing, and the effort to change isn't that bad. It's not even that hard to change, but saying goodbye to this life. I like sitting on the floor of the Bulls games. I could see them sweat. An old way of thinking, a person in our life who should not be there, a lifestyle habit, maybe even it's becoming an addiction, but saying goodbye to it, even when it is perfectly clear that you should have said goodbye a long time ago. But now, if I didn't say goodbye then, what? We reason with ourselves that life may be better, but this life is good enough. And Jesus says to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." He's not calling Peter the devil in this moment. Satan or Shaitan in the Hebrew or the Greek, it means adversary. It means obstacle. It means, Peter, your embarrassment, your selfishness, your willingness to keep this life is getting in God's way. You have your mindset on human things. When God tells us what to do, but we're worried about whose feelings we might hurt. When we know we're supposed to do a particular thing, but we're saying, oh, well, I need to wait a little while because I got to finish this, 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 and this first. You think you're being busy. You're being the devil. You're getting in God's way. When we're rushing to do something because of our anxiety to finish, we've got to finish this. We've got to get done with this. God told me to do it, but then the Spirit says, wait, be still. When we want to do the right thing, but we also want to protect ourselves, keep our luxuries. We want to keep this life we have. Yeah, no, I want to make sure black people are free, but as long as I ain't got to lose nothing. When we want to keep our privileges, keep our old lives, when we fall in love with this life, say that, this life. This life you have built for yourself, when we get in God's way with this life. What is our Satan? Whatever is keeping us from fully experiencing God. Our fear can be a Satan. Our pride can be a Satan. The junk that needs to go. Why are we hoarding it? Why are we saving it? What do we think it will do if we keep it? I was watching the town hall from the NRA and Marco Rubio this week. Did anybody else watch that town hall? I know y'all are woke folks. Oh, most of y'all watch this, all right? Down in Florida, and it was going, well, how was it going? It was going as expected. No surprises, and Rubio, he's a composed cat. I like watching him, because he got an answer for everything. It doesn't matter. And his face barely ever moves. But then somebody in the crowd asked, it wasn't really a question, it was more like a demand, really. Stop taking money from the NRA. And will you now say that you will stop taking money from the NRA? And his face in that moment. What? Whatever he said out loud, his face gave the real answer. Reject the NRA? Are you serious? That's how I got here. They gave me this life. No, I'm not rejecting the NRA. He said something else, but that was his answer. Oh, we'll find an answer about guns and wait. If somebody brings us a good policy, I'll consider it. I won't worry about the NRA. No, he was like, look, you crazy. I'm not rejecting the NRA, and whatever they tell me to do, I'm going to do. Marco Rubio has an A-plus score with the NRA. Their money is his bread and butter. Say, this life. I almost felt sorry for him. He couldn't imagine another way. To keep this life, what are we willing to do to keep our comfort? I have friends who are pastors. And the question is, it's a little case study. If you're at a bar and someone asks what do you tell them? Will you tell them you're a pastor? This is no easy answer. People say all sorts of things, first of all. People say all kind of stuff to you when they find out you're a pastor. All right? Not even at a bar. Like, anywhere, right? At 7-Eleven, right? But, like, if you had a bar, here's what happens. Oh, you're a pastor? And then the next 30 minutes is them apologizing. Like, they just apologize a lot. People apologize to pastors a lot, and they don't realize how drunk they are. And so they're oversharing. Now, I'm just trying to relax. I'm just trying to relax, okay? But I think about the saints and what they would say if they were ever asked about God. Those that are ashamed of me and my words. I don't want the labels, the assumptions, the responsibility. I don't want to talk about the Catholic Church and all of its malfeasance over the years. I don't want to do that. I don't want the responsibility in that moment. What if I just took my cross and just laid it down over there for a second? This life is good enough. God can wait. Those who want to save this life will lose it. Those who want to save this life will lose it. And those who will save their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel. I mean, I was watching that town hall and it became clear that there was an opportunity in the midst of national mourning, in the midst of a well-worn conversation about gun policy. It's nothing we haven't heard. There was an opportunity for one of our elected officials to say, look, y'all, let's get beyond the Democrat and Republican. Look, 17 people just died and there's something wrong with our country's obsession and cultural fixation with guns. I don't know what it is. I don't know the solution. None of us do, but there is something wrong. I don't know if it's policy, but something is wrong because kids are dying. To risk this, to say this for the sake of truth, for the sake of the gospel, to be on the side of hurting just one time. Not to be on the side of the aisle, but to be on the side of hurting. To hear our president say, you know, what we need to ban is video games. What? What? Shut up. Like, what are you talking about? To see people so emboldened after 17 people are killed, people would rather protect their relationship with the NRA than to name what we know to be true. Those who want to save their life will lose it. Those who see common sense, who see the pain of others, who see the margins and instead turn the other way will to save this life. Those who want to save this life. Some lives are not worth saving. I'm not talking about murder. I'm not advocating for anyone here to harm themselves. No. But the life that is built on lies, the life that is constructed around the oppression of people, the life that is afraid, the life that is proud, the life that steals, the life that hates itself, the life that looks in the mirror and says, there's nothing there, that life is not worth saving. All of us have within us lives that are not worth saving. Me too. Parts of us that, you know what, they need to go, and the quicker they go, the better. What do we think we will gain by keeping this old life? By grasping to parts of ourselves that are dying? By resisting the change that is happening within? What do we think we will gain by not changing? Peter, what is it you think you're doing right now? If you want to follow me, do what you're supposed to do. At a certain point, we must put down our life and take up the cross of Christ. God is reminding us throughout the gospel and in the scripture that for a part of Jesus' life to be fulfilled, for him to be fulfilled, he had to take up the cross. He had to go through the process of dying. And so too must we let some things die so that we can truly be alive. I'm not speaking shallow here. I know this is resonating with somebody who's struggling with a habit or an addiction or something you've just been doing your entire life. I know that. I know that we're thinking of ways of being that don't fit up when they're held to the light of God. I know we're looking at that banner that says sin and we're resonating with that. It's something's hitting us in that moment. But it's worked for us. I'm not saying either that if you give it up right now, even if you pray really, really hard and give it up, that it'll be gone. No, it'll be waiting for you. God is not our maid, y'all. And God will not clean it up for us. We cannot just leave things sitting here. What we'll notice is that it will continue to accumulate. This is work. This is work. This life is work, and carrying the cross is work. Doing what we're supposed to be doing is work. Speaking up when it's not comfortable to speak up, when it risks to speak up and do, that's work, and it will stretch you and take you to new places. It will horrify and excite you. You will make mistakes, too. You're going to make a lot of mistakes, but you can do it. With God, all things are possible, church. With God, and I mean with God, meaning we need to stop being ashamed of our faith. In this world where God talk is seen as the stuff of fools, when we hear people talk on our Instagrams and our social medias about God, it's like, oh, one of those again. When we hear people in the grocery store talking about God, oh, I don't know about that. But look at all the talk about God as being owned by a theology I can't get with. Who is going to talk about justice? Who is going to talk about love? Who is going to talk about being faithful in a broken world? I mean, with Esther Newley, it was obvious that she loved God. She prayed and prayed and prayed. But when we leave this world, how many people from the next generation will know that we were faithful? How are we going to know that you were faithful? How will we find the people who are supposed to act like Jesus, to talk like Jesus, to give up their floor seats and do justice? Will our children know that we prayed for them? And while we are fighting for them, will we also pray for them? Will they know our journey and know our struggle over a way that with tears has been watered? Will they know? If some churches back American exploitation, greed, estrangement, prosperity, how will people know about the God who delivered the Israelites from Egypt? How will they know who God is if we do not emerge from our fear and show them? If we do not cast our pride and our fear aside to be with people in their pain, if we do not risk our words and our actions for the sake of the gospel, those who seek to keep this life will lose it. Peter thought he was protecting Jesus. He thought he was being a good friend in that moment. But he was getting in God's way so he could protect himself. We can use this silence to ask ourselves which part of our lives we are trying too hard to save. We can use this silence to ask about a time when others could have used our faith to discover their own. But we were silent. We can ask about that, and we can ask what's next. What's worth keeping and carrying, and what needs losing? Because everything is not worth saving. Amen.